Jim Cott has been involved in professional baseball for 6 decades as both a pitcher and a broadcaster. In those years, he earned 283 victories on the mound and 7 Emmy Awards in the booth. His newest venture is as a co-author of a new book, If These Walls Could Talk, New York Yankees, providing behind-the-scenes tales during his time with baseball's most distinguished franchise. And Jim, before we get into some of the details of the book, one notable part of your playing career was as a member of the Minnesota Twins, having to face Sandy Koufax 3 times in the 1965 World Series. You won Game 2, but Koufax threw a two-hitter in Game 7 and the Dodgers won 2-0, so no shame in being on the losing end of that. But what kind of pressure did you feel in those starts, those 3 starts, knowing he was capable of shutting your offense down and thus giving you little margin for error?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't feel much pressure at all because I was facing the Dodger lineup. He was facing our lineup. I thought we had a stronger lineup than they did. I didn't really feel like I was pitching against Sandy, and for the most part, no one would have expected me to win it all against him anyway. So, you know, game one, we were fortunate to squeeze out a couple runs against him, and he was lifted for a pinch hitter. But game five and game seven, he was just so dominant. So, you know, I knew there wasn't much margin for error, but you can't really change the way you pitch. I mean, you can't throw harder or try to make your curve break better, bigger. You just do the best you can and hope you can hold them down and we can scratch out a couple runs, but he was much too good for that.
Jim Cott and Sandy Koufax are the rival starters for the 3rd time in the series. And now it's a final showdown.
Jim Cott tried to throw a slider several years ago and decided that as a result of throwing the slider that his curveball was less effective. But then he went back to using the slider and now regards it as one of his most effective pitches. Cott was a winner over the Dodgers and Sandy Koufax here at Metropolitan Stadium, a loser to the Dodgers and Koufax at Dodger Stadium. And so today's the pitchers have identical World Series records in 1965, 1 win, 1 loss.
Not only did you go on to win 25 games in 1966 and 283, as we just mentioned, over a 25-year career, you previously held the record for gold gloves by a pitcher, 16 of them all consecutively, until Greg Maddux surpassed it. How much of that fielding success was instinct, and how much is due to continued practice?
Well, when I was a kid, my baseball hero was Bobby Shantz. I was a little guy. I was usually the smallest in my class, especially on my team, and didn't grow until, you know, get up to 6'4", 6'5", later when I was 19 or 20. And Bobby Shantz, for the younger fans that have never heard of him, was a 5'7" lefty, won the MVP, I believe, in 51, won 24 games. And when my dad was a huge Philadelphia Athletics fan, so I took a liking to Bobby Shantz, and I heard the radio announcers describe his motion and what a great fielder he was, and I would go in the backyard and mimic his motion. And my first year in spring training doing pitcher's fielding drills, our pitching coach said, "Hey, kid, you look just like Bobby Shantz." So I worked at it, and I patterned myself after maybe the best. I know Greg Maddux won a couple of more gold gloves than I did, and I think they didn't give the gold glove award way early in Bobby's career, but many that saw him feel like he may have been the best.
After playing with the Twins franchise, the White Sox, and the Phillies, you joined the New York Yankees in 1979, of course owned by George Steinbrenner, no question the most imposing and complex figure in team history. You played in the Pinstripes as part of this for part of the 79 and 1980 seasons, but in between those seasons, you had some interesting contract negotiations with Steinbrenner, correct?
I really did. I didn't know George that well, and most of my negotiations, particularly coming from the Phillies with Rudy Carpenter, Paul Owens, was there was a lot of trust there. And so George had, Billy had asked if I would come back in 1980. Billy really didn't ask. I said, "Do you think I could still pitch?" And Billy Martin said, "Yeah, I want you back in 1980. And I went up and talked to George about it. He was cool. And he said, "I just have to remove you from the roster till December to protect one of our young kids." But then suddenly he forgot what he promised me, and that was pretty disappointing, and I spoke out quite loudly about it. But the thing about George is, as time passed on, when it came time for me to be hired as a broadcaster, he completely overlooked that, and we ended up having a very, very good relationship here in my last year there, 2007, with the Yankees. So we had a very, very civil relationship.
Yeah, how did that relationship evolve going forward? I mean, how much, what did you ultimately kind of learn from him, maybe that you didn't know in the beginning?
Well, I think if you don't actually work directly for him, I was not really under the employ of the New York Yankees. I worked for Madison Square Garden Network, I worked for WPIX, and I worked for the YES Network. He had to approve me, but I didn't answer to him on a daily basis. And I think after listening to things that I said over the air, you know, he had respect for me sticking up for what I thought was right. And I think that's one of the reasons that it evolved into a relationship for where he respected what I stood for.
Shortly after your playing career in 1986, the Yankees hired you to call games for WPIX with Phil Rizzuto and Bill White. But Jim, is it true that you really began your broadcasting experience while you were still on the Twins back in the 60s?
Well, in those days, in the 60s, you needed a job in the off season. We didn't have the lucrative contracts that you have today. And I happened to be doing a radio interview with Ray Scott, who at the time was the voice of the Green Bay Packers and also did Twins games. And of course, a typical question is for in those days was, well, when your playing career is over, what do you aspire to do? You know, nowadays they make enough money that they don't have to do anything. But I just off the cuff said, well, what you guys do seems like it's kind of fun, maybe being an announcer. And the next day the Twins got a call from Bob Zellner, who owned and managed a 500-watt daytime station in Shakopee, Minnesota. And he hired me, I think, for the grand sum of $300-$400 a month, which was enough to pay bills in the winter. And I started doing high school sports, basketball, football. I signed on in the morning doing a livestock report and all the things that small-town radio announcers do. So it was a good experience.
And as I mentioned, you work with Phil Rizzuto, who was a great Yankee shortstop and then a legendary announcer, a character in his own right. And I had heard that he left games early. I didn't know if that was really true. And then I read the part of your book where he actually did and left you doing play-by-play. Is that right?
Yeah, in one night in Cleveland in the old stadium where it could get just bitter cold, you know, they call it the mistake on the lake because they didn't draw many people and the wind would whip around and it was just a very raw place to be, not a lot of excitement there. And we had a three-man rotation, so let's say Bill and Scooter did the first three and then Bill and I would do the second three, so Bill's night was done, and Scooter and I would do the last three. So Scooter called everybody by their last name. He said, "Cot, I'll be right back. I have to go to the men's room." And he went, he never came back, and the inning started, and I began to call the plays, and the producer said to my ear, "Where's Rizzuto?" And I said, "Well, he went to the men's room." You know, I have my talk back button so it doesn't go over the air. I said, "He said he went to the men's room. He'll be right back." He said, "No, he's not coming back." And that's how I got my baptism of doing play-by-play and working three innings by myself.
Now, from 1995 to 2006, you were back as a Yankees announcer and were able to witness up close a team that would go on to win four World Series in a five-year span. What made that team able to have such sustained excellence in a free agency era?
Well, you know, there's a lot of good fortune involved. You have to have the right collection of players. I mean, the Yankees had no idea how good El Duque would be, or Mariano Rivera, even Ramiro Mendoza. Derek Jeter came on the scene in 1995. Joe Torre took over, who was a really calming influence for the players. I think shielded them from some of George's tirades and handled the media very well. And they just had a lot of experienced, what I call complete baseball players. Paul O'Neill, Tino Martinez, Bernie Williams, Scott Brosius, they got in a trade, and of course Derek got better and better every year. They went through several different second basemen. Joe Girardi was a force behind the plate, and they had a solid starting rotation and an outstanding bullpen, so they really had no weakness. I mean, I don't know if they had gold glovers at every position, but they certainly played well enough in the field. But they just had a great collection of baseball players and didn't rely on one or two superstars.
One of the many memorable moments during that Yankee dynasty, aside from the championships, of course, included David Wells' perfect game in 1998 against the Twins, and you were doing play-by-play in the top of the ninth. Was there any bit of trepidation on your end, knowing that this call could be replayed over and over should he finish the deal in the last half inning?
Not really. I had worked Doc Gooden's no-hitter a couple of years before that, and I never tried to think ahead of time of how something should be called. I just kind of let it evolve, and that's what I did there. I remember the last out was a fly ball to Paul O'Neill in right field, but we sort of had the inkling after about the second inning, because the Twins, the only experienced hitter they had in the lineup really was Paul Molitor, and Boomer was making it look very, very easy, so it really was not that surprising to see him continue to carry that perfect game into the late innings, and we just kind of let it play out.
Popped up right field near the line. O'Neill appears to have room. He puts it away, and David Wells has pitched a perfect game. Come to the ballpark. Almost 50,000 here. And from the third inning on, when David Wells struck out the side, I think, Kenny, that fans had a sense that something special was happening.
There's a look at the last pitch, and he knows it's a done deal. It's headed in the direction of Paul O'Neill, and it's over.
The 15th regular season perfect game in Major League history, and the first ever at Yankee Stadium. What a day for it. What a wonderful crowd. Almost looks like the last out of the World Series.
You know, when you think about it, Kenny, you go back a couple of starts and David Wells was mad at the world, right? In Texas. A few starts later, they carry him off the field here at Yankee Stadium.
You spent a lot of time behind the mic with Ken Singleton, a veteran of 15 big league seasons. Did you find it easier to call a game beside a fellow player such as Singleton because you had that common bond?
No question. I mean, I think the easiest and the ideal way when you cover a team for an entire season is with another former player who can also do play-by-play, and you just talk baseball. I mean, when we do our showcase games now, Bob Costas is, the gold standard of network announcers and play-by-play announcers, and he gives the game gives the game a lot of credibility. Once they hear his name, people say, "Wow, this must be an important game." And it is, and it's great to work with Bob. But on a daily basis, covering a team, it was very relaxing, and just like sitting in the stands with a former player and talking baseball for a few hours. And when you do as many games as Kenny and I did, that's important. Instead of making one game the big game of the week, we had a game to do almost every night.
Since 2009, you've been an analyst with MLB Network, as you just touched on, and just last September had the opportunity to sit in on Derek Jeter's final home game. I recall watching the broadcast, you doing color, Bob Costas doing play-by-play, both marveling, as we all were, at the way it all played out, culminating in his walk-off single. Costas mentioned after the game that it was one of the highlights of his announcing career. A strong statement from someone of his stature. How special was the night for you, considering you saw him come to the big leagues and pretty much develop before your eyes into one of the all-time great Yankees?
Well, I think it was the most satisfying and memorable game I have ever done because, as you mentioned, knowing Derek and covering him, we had a dedicated camera on him, and just to see his mood, you could tell he was not comfortable. It's the most uncomfortable night I think he ever had playing shortstop, and understandably so, knowing it was going to be his last game. And I said to our producer, Chris Pfeiffer, this could be an easy game to do if we just don't mess it up and talk too much. We just have to sit back and stay out of the way and kind of comment on what Derek's reactions are. And I think we did a good job of that. And it was a memorable game. It had a storybook ending that you just couldn't possibly script. And just like Bob said, I think it was, the best I've ever done from a satisfaction standpoint.
Derek Jeter.
Jeter has one plate appearance against Evan Meek, and he walked. Waiting for Joseph to get down in the crouch. He's still standing. If he extends his right arm, he'll be able to hear the boos all the way to Staten Island. But instead, he gets into a crouch.
Competitive as Buck is, I don't think he dares to do this.
That was a great tactic that you guys had. It's a Vin Scully tactic he always used to talk about. You know, a great moment and he just gets out of the way and it almost makes it, enhances the moment and almost makes the announcer that much more credible.
Yeah, I think that's what, I had good training from Dick Enberg and Dick Stockton and John Madden I spent time talking to and listening to announcers. And the good ones, once there's something exciting happening, you lay out. Sometimes producers will say ahead of time, now look, if this happens, lay out. I don't want to hear anything. And I'm fortunate to have been trained by announcers like that I know better, that when an exciting moment comes up, you lay out and you let the director show the crowd reaction and the player reaction, and it doesn't need any words when the pictures are there. They tell the whole story.
Well, for detailed accounts about the Yankees, especially the recent dynasty, if these walls could talk, New York Yankees is a great source. Jim, a great pleasure talking with you. Continued success with the book and in the broadcast booth.
All right, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.